Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Welcome, everybody, to today's episode of Displacement Urbanism. Our episode today is titled How to Build Capacity, Asylum Design Labs for London Councils. I'm delighted to introduce our guest for today, Melissa Waymayer, who is a researcher at the Center for Migration, Policy and Society, Compass, at Oxford University, where she designs knowledge exchange initiatives to bridge academia, policy and practice to support migrant integration. Previously, Melissa worked with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees through its interagency project, the Joint IDP Profiling Service. She partnered with a variety of UN humanitarian development and government stakeholders to build a trusted evidence base on internal forced migration, especially in Central America and the Middle East. We are very fortunate that she has a PhD from us here in the Department of Geography and Environment, and particularly in the Regional and Urban Planning Studies program. And her work with us focused on how local authorities develop responses to asylum, and some of that was also located in the UK. Welcome to the podcast, Melissa.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here, Romola.
So, you know, your work has been so amazing and I've learned so much from it. So I thought it would be really nice to have you on here to share some of your insights with the audience and talk about some of the things that you found through your work. So one of the places that you did your research on was London, and a lot of the work that you were doing was looking at asylum provision. So I wanted to just start our conversation today by talking about why London? Like, why is London exceptional in asylum provision, and why you think that's the case?
Yeah, thank you so much. I've learned a lot from the Displacement Urbanism podcast, so it is really exciting to be able to contribute. So my research in London came initially from work experience. So I was working with the Greater London Authority as part of its migration team, building their capacity on working and supporting local authorities on asylum. That was an absolutely fascinating area, so I brought it into my PhD research over time, and I can talk more about that later. So why London? In a way, it happened because of that experience. But I quickly learned that the reason London needed to build their capacity so quickly on asylum was because they had a significant number of asylum seekers come in the aftermath of COVID-19. So that was a time when the backlogs on asylum processing were becoming so long that the Conservative government at the time introduced a policy to start housing people seeking asylum in hotels. Previously, London really had fallen off the map when it came to asylum research. In the 90s, most people seeking asylum would come to a port of entry and then be bused right to London. But because that was becoming too much for councils at the time, the 1999 Immigration and Asylum Act started a system of dispersing people asylum across the UK. And so 20 years later, all of a sudden, London was getting a really significant number of people seeking asylum being housed in hotels. And why London? It's because they have a lot of hotels. So it's not just that London was disproportionately affected compared to the rest of the UK. It was also that some boroughs in London were disproportionately affected. For example, the boroughs of Hillingdon and Hounslow together host around 20% of people seeking asylum supported by the government in London. And that's just because of Heathrow Airport. There happens to be lots of hotels there. And so, taking the example of Hillingdon and Hounslow, for them, it was a really big challenge. It was hard to predict how many people would arrive, when they would arrive, and how long they would stay. So, when the Home Office would then relocate them to other parts of the UK. So, the council there had a real planning challenge with a lot of uncertainty. So, they were trying to figure out how they should react when 1 week they might get over 1,000 people, and the next week they might get under 100. They just didn't know. So, what the council did, as an example, is they focused on getting people their initial health checks, working with NHS offices in the area. But then they struggled with the question of whether or not to actually sign them up for a GP, a general practitioner, since they didn't know how long they would be around. So these are, in a way, some very practical issues the council faced that were not really accounted for in the central government's asylum accommodation policies. And so, in short, I feel that London is exceptional in that it really does have the highest number of people seeking asylum compared to other parts of the UK. According to the latest Home Office data sets, as of the end of September of 2025, just over 16% of people seeking asylum across the UK are based in London, and just over 11,000 of them are housed in hotels. The only other region, so that you have a sense of context, with more asylum seekers is the northwest of the UK. But they're mostly housed in what we call dispersed accommodation. So that means being housed within the community, and under 5,000 of them are in hotels. So London really has the biggest hotel population. They had to scale up their capacity very quickly. And they also struggle with some of the challenges that all local authorities face in the UK, which is this kind of unclear role within a very centralized policy area.
That is really, really interesting and very informative. And I wanted to just ask you a little bit more on this, just to tell us about how local councils were addressing the challenges around asylum provision, when you were doing this work with them.
Yeah, so that's a good question because actually a lot of people don't know. When I speak with even people that are very active in the voluntary sector here in London, providing support to people seeking asylum, they are sometimes surprised when I tell them about the things that local authorities here are doing. So I think there is a big gap in knowledge on what councils can and should do and are actually already doing. Part of that is because they tend to not publicize that work. So it was really useful within my research to build trusted relationships with council officers so that I can actually understand what they're doing behind the scenes. Generally, councils were very much on the back foot when it came to responding to asylum. They were struggling with the rapid changes to central government policies. Struggling to understand them, struggling to then know what to do about them. And they also, in many cases, didn't really have the expertise at first to understand the asylum-seeking population. But that doesn't mean they weren't doing anything, as I said. So some areas that I would summarize as proactive response by councils are providing wraparound services, using a public health approach, and changing their institutional structures to respond more efficiently. So starting with the first one, wraparound services. So I have to preface this by saying not all councils were doing this. Some councils in London decided themselves that they wanted to bring provision to people seeking asylum in hotels. And they called this wraparound services because the kind of provision they were bringing was presumably all the things that the central government policy didn't do, such as connecting them to English language courses, such as helping connect them to local schools, such as finding ways to provide school uniforms for kids, In a way, some of these details seem small, but taken together, they can make a huge difference to the experience of a family or even an individual seeking asylum in that particular area. So it can help them feel more comfortable, can mitigate a little bit of the uncertainty of their situation. And by connecting them to local services, it can also, we hope, help introduce them to other locals in the area, help them feel more integrated in that area. So these wraparound services were sometimes the council commissioning an NGO to provide these services to sit within the hotels, or hiring people in-house to sit within the hotels. So the council was directly providing the services. Or a third option was kind of a mix of both. Thinking about the public health approach to be more multi-sectoral, this was something that came out of the public health departments within councils, who had a lot of experience doing this for vulnerable populations as a result of COVID, but also because this is part of their bread and butter. So they would take the same approach to asylum by developing a multi-sectoral strategy for that, how they would bring other departments within the council together to provide specific services or to at least do some outreach and be available. And then finally, changing their institutional structures. This is something I started seeing further down the line. So after they had developed some of those wraparound services and other programs, council saw that if they were just responding from their children's department or from within their housing department, they were meeting some barriers in what they could do. So in some cases, a council would decide to change where their asylum work was situated within the council, for example, to a community outreach team or to a strategy level team, and that would help them access other council resources. It would help them maybe work in a more multi-sectoral way. So I did see some of those changes to institutional structures happen later on. So when we actually started this design lab process that I can tell you more about, one of the biggest challenges that councils were facing is that they didn't actually know what their role should and could be for supporting people seeking asylum. And I would actually view asylum, yes, it's really interesting and important to be understanding how asylum provision came about in the first place. But if we think of asylum as a case of a complex city governance challenge, I think it's an area where increasingly we see that it should be of concern to local and city governments, and that local and city governments bring a lot of value to addressing this policy area. So it's not necessarily the case, given that immigration policies themselves are developed and enforced by central governments. But I believe I'm seeing a trend towards that in London and through this research as well. You can compare this kind of policy area to other areas that were in the past really under the responsibility of central government that increasingly became an area of municipal or local government concern. For example, there's a brilliant case study by Wendy Mendes in Vancouver looking at how food security initially was something that was thought of as being entirely managed by the central level, by the agricultural ministry in Canada. But then through activism and a lot of other arguments made, the local government saw how important it was for them to be taking on board this issue. And now we take it for granted that local governments should and could work on migration in the same way that we take it for granted that food security is important to look at the city level.
That is such an important reflection. I mean, it's so important to kind of think about what the local governments are doing, what they're providing, and how these kinds of issues also impact them, and so how they can get involved. You had mentioned Design Lab, and I think it would be really interesting to talk about that and to talk about, what the Design Lab was, what was being done in it, and, what if anything it achieved for those who were participating in it as well.
Yeah, thank you. So the design labs were a process that was funded by the Greater London Authority, intended to build the capacity of local authorities that were working, struggling, trying to develop some kind of response to asylum at a time when they were on, as I said, the back foot. So this process was carried out from around January 2022 to June 2022. So it feels like a long time ago now, but it really did have a long-lasting impact. And I think that is still relevant to discuss today. What it actually comprised of was a series of six workshops informed by some evidence that was separately commissioned by the Greater London Authority. So, two in-depth case studies from boroughs in London and the experience of asylum seekers in those boroughs. The idea was that through the course of these six workshops, bringing together 11 different local councils, the officers from these councils would be able to really delve into those case studies, consider their own situations within their councils and their boroughs, discuss with each other, effectively debate what they should do about it, what they could do about it, and how they can actually go about doing something differently, and then carrying it out. So the fact that we had these workshops spread out over the course of 6 months meant that in between the workshops, the team implementing these design labs could be in touch with those councils to mentor them effectively, brainstorm ways to develop a pilot project according to the priorities of each of these different councils, so that by the end of those 6 months, they actually had a new program or policy or practice that they were able to put in place to improve their response to asylum. In that sense, the design lab helped us move forward, but also during the process and through the workshops, we realized just how much unclarity there was and how much the space for discussion was needed just to, not even just to brainstorm, but to share knowledge for these councils to actually realize that they weren't alone in struggling with these problems, and also to build connections between councils. So that was the kind of structure of the design lab process. I saw it as an important participatory approach because the Greater London Authority wasn't telling these councils how to run their asylum responses. In fact, the Greater London Authority, they're not necessarily operational in the same way. They don't know, they have a bird's eye view, but they don't actually know the inner workings of each council and how best they can address these issues. It was a process of asking each of the participating councils what their biggest challenges were and how they saw that they could most effectively address them. So the outputs were not predefined, they were developed in collaboration with the councils throughout. When I speak with the participants of the design lab, so I was fortunate to be able to observe all of the workshops and then interview the participants separately for my PhD research alongside, I saw that yes, the design labs did enable them to carry out their specific pilot projects. They had differing levels of success, with the biggest challenge being that each of these projects took way longer to develop than the participants anticipated. We called it time slippage. So they needed, another 6 months after the scope of the project in order to actually put them in place, whether it was creating a volunteering program for people seeking asylum to develop their job skills or making it easier for people to take entrance exams for English provision. Whatever specific thing it was, it took a lot longer. So that was a big lesson learned. But they did absolutely build networks with each other that they talked about having been totally fragmented after the experience of COVID-19. So because all of the local governments here switched to home working, they just lost touch with each other. And so they didn't really have that space to call each other up. Just the opportunity to be able to call another officer in a neighboring council to say, okay, this asylum seeking family is leaving a hotel in our council, in our borough, and they're going to yours. Can you just make sure that you have some preparations in place to enroll them into a different school? Something like that. That does make a huge difference in the lives of those people moving around. Did it actually make a bigger difference? So, beyond those specific pilot projects, yes, I do believe it did. I think it led to a mindset shift in the sense that people actually talked about asylum differently afterwards. So, there were two examples. One is We talked about the concept of social integration within the workshops. This is a concept that's been developed and promoted by the Greater London Authority, but it's hard to operationalize. What does it actually mean? It's a concept of integration that isn't specific to migrants, but is more about making connections across all kinds of groups that may be different in a community. So, three of the 11 participating councils actually did manage to formalize their understanding of social integration into their council plans. So that seems like quite a big change, and others followed suit afterwards. And secondly, people changed the way that they described asylum seekers. Instead of calling them simply asylum seekers, they started talking about them as asylum-seeking residents. So residents of that borough. Even if they were there temporarily, if, for example, the Home Office would then move them to a different borough or a different city, they were still considered residents. And that helped councils to basically make arguments internally to open up funding to provide more services to them. So to use council revenues to provide those services rather than just waiting for central government grants. So that seems like actually a really big change. And when I follow up with councils, they're still using that language that was discussed and debated within the design labs.
This is such an interesting point that you were making about how the process itself changes that language. And I think that it's such a positive move to get to that point. And you painted such an interesting picture. And as you said, that not many people know that this sort of work is done. But you've obviously come into this space as a researcher. And I was wondering, given that you were able to observe what was going on as this kind of outsider, what did you think some of the challenges were? What would your advice be for those who are doing this kind of policy work from your vantage point?
Yeah, thank you. It was an absolutely amazing opportunity to collaborate both with the Greater London Authority, but also with the many local council officers that were part of this design lab process. It wasn't always easy, and I think the biggest challenge was finding out the ways that academic research can actually support practitioners in these very challenging policy areas. So, when a council is trying to deal with 1,000 or more people coming to a hotel in their borough needing medical care of some kind, they're not going to be thinking about the wider implications of their work. But here I was as a researcher asking questions about what does this mean in general. And so I needed to adapt my research questions to their pace of working and the urgency of the situation. I would advise, and what actually worked well for me in doing this is that I have different sets of research questions with different timescales. So I was very interested in their immediate challenges, and they were also prioritizing those immediate challenges. So for me, just trying to understand what those were and categorizing them in a way that maybe grouped some of those challenges together, feeding that back to them and saying, I'm really interested in the challenges around outreach in hotels. How are you managing this internally? That's something that spoke their language and was also of interest to them. They wanted to know what other councils were doing for that as well. So, I had a set of questions that were really thinking through their perspective on how to deal with immediate challenges. But then I also had a longer-term set of questions, which were more analytical, I guess you could say, asking why. Why do they have these challenges? And where do these challenges come from? Whereas I think they were more interested in how do we address them, asking the question about why. Gets to some of the political issues around asylum and migration policy in a way that they didn't really have time to reflect on. They knew that there were politics involved left, right, and center, and clearly any central government announcement, which itself was laden with all kinds of political undertones or overtones, as it is often the case in migration, would affect their immediate work. But that wasn't really what they needed to address, and it wasn't what they thought would help the people seeking asylum coming to them with some really urgent issues. What I came up with are some key lessons that the design lab offered, which is a rethinking of the concept of capacity and capacity building. During the discussions, we often came back to this back and forth about how central government policies were hindering the work at the local level, in part because of all the rapid changes, but also in part because there was very little funding being given to the local level to do any work. That is actually quite a paralyzing discussion. You can't really go to a space of solutions and problem solving from there because all you're saying is, there's not enough money, there's not enough money, we need more money. Maybe, yes, there needs to be some kind of advocacy strategy for explaining why more funding is needed, but we have to get past that to try to understand what is already being done and what can be done and what should be done. So I saw capacity building as a process that had three different intersecting components. One was having all those debates to establish the roles and goals of local authorities. So overcoming some of those key dilemmas that they were facing, like asylum seekers being rapidly moved from borough to borough. So how can they actually connect them to services? They needed to spend the time talking about that in order to figure out where their added value is as local government. Secondly, I saw an important element of confidence building within the process. So local authorities, especially when they felt like they were on their back foot, they were so stressed and they were struggling because they empathized with the challenges that asylum seekers were facing and yet had no tools at their disposal to do anything about them. You know, this compares to, for example, those that were also supporting the Homes for Ukraine program, where they felt like they actually had things they could offer to help people, whereas with asylum seekers, they just didn't. That was a real struggle. So, in actually coming together to gain some knowledge about asylum, to develop those networks, to share problem-solving techniques, they were much more confident in this policy area by the last workshop. And that was a really big change. It made them actually able to think of more solutions that they wouldn't have before. They were literally less stressed. The third component is then that very traditional area of capacity building that people often think about. So the resources and the tools that you would need to actually implement policies and programs. But I think we overdo that last bit and we don't really talk so much about the first two parts. So actually establishing the roles and goals and then building confidence. So going through this design lab process while everybody else was working on their specific pilot projects, the Greater London Authority was developing a toolkit to try to bring all the knowledge out to other councils across London. I was thinking about what can we learn from the challenges in general? Why did they have these challenges and how can they overcome them? And I saw this very specific capacity building process as being quite important.
This was so interesting. And, you know, I mean, I loved that you were talking about the fact that, you know, you could get paralyzed with this discussion of there's not enough funding, especially given that that space of funding is shrinking, not just within the London context, but in other contexts as well. But there is an opportunity to sort of rethink things operationally. And to think about, yes, we may not have the funds to do these things, but what do we have that we could build on in terms of capacity? And what are other ways in which we can support people who need that kind of help? I think it's also been really interesting talking to you and kind of understanding local governments as a really key actor in this space, not just as actors that are being confronted with people coming into their jurisdictions, but also who are trying to be active in supporting them in different ways and what they're trying to do in order to do that. So the participatory workshops, I think, are really fantastic. And I have no doubt that there are many other local governments that are also thinking of really interesting and innovative ways in which to support refugees and asylum seekers and other displaced people who are coming into their areas and into their communities and so on. So I think it's really helpful to kind of think about what people are doing and how they're trying to work beyond their constraints. Thank you so much for being on the podcast with us today, Melissa. It's been so fantastic talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.